Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. I believe we do. I'm not sure if we have a quorum present yet, but we will start with the roll, and then I need to go present a bill in another committee, and so then Vice Chair Mohler will ably take over for us this morning. Anna, go ahead.
Chairmaker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mohler.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
I don't know if we lost Chair Becker Finn already. Chair Becker Finn, are you there? Anna, do we have a quorum?
Yes, a quorum is present.
Okay, members, a quorum is present. So today we'll be hearing three bills. We've got House File 701 from Representative Lippert. Our plan is to move that out of committee. We have House File 478 by Representative Feist. Again, there'll be a motion to move that out of committee. And House File 1163, Representative Winkler. Again, there'll be a motion to move that out of committee. But before we do that, we need approval of the minutes. And Representative Scott, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes. Thank you.
So Representative Scott moves to approve the minutes for February 25, 2021. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 25, 2021 are approved. And our first bill up today is House File 701, Representative Lippert, on soil health farming goals established. And members, we are going to be focusing our committee discussion today on the relevant data provisions of this bill, sections 1 and 4. And welcome to the committee, Representative Lippert. Since you're not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 701 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. And before we get into a discussion about your bill, Representative Lippert, I believe that there are two amendments, and we'll start with the A1 author's amendment, which I believe puts the bill in the shape that you desire. Is that correct, Representative Lippert?
Yes, there are two amendments, Madam Chair, and once we vote both of them in, the bill will be in the shape that I'd like to see it.
Okay, great. So we'll start with the A1 amendment, and I move that the A1 amendment, I will move the A1 amendment. And do we have any questions or discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted, and the A2 amendment also puts the bill in the shape the author desires. So I will move the A2 amendment. Do we have any discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. And now, finally, Representative Lippert, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So at a high level, this bill does two things. First, it sets goals for the adoption of soil health building practices statewide. Second, it puts a robust cost share program in place to help farmers adopt these practices. These practices are key to making our soils more resilient in the face of increasingly extreme rain events due to climate change. They'll help the land retain more water, helping to mitigate flooding for communities downstream, improving water quality too, and some of the practices sequester carbon in the soil in significant ways. The science is emerging on how much carbon these practices sequester, depending on the soil type and the type of practice. So we want to be gathering data to ensure that solid science can give us better and better information about the practices that sequester the most carbon, increase organic matter in the soil the most, and create the healthiest, most resilient soil. The A2 amendment that we adopted, or you adopted, addresses the data-related sections in the bill. In Subdivision 6A, we worked with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information and agreed to compromise language that allows for the data related to farmers' soils to remain private while the contact information of the farmers who are receiving grant funds is public data. And then this amendment also changed the language in Section 4. We worked with the Minnesota Office for Soil Health to come up with language that makes clear this data collection is about advancing emerging soil science. And Bowser, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and the Institute on the Environment will be measuring how soil health indicators change on various fields rather than on every field, as we had in the initial version of the bill. With me to testify and say more about the bill is Amanda Kohler of the Land Stewardship Project.
Great. Thank you, Representative Lippert. Amanda, welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name, introduce yourself, and go right ahead.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for having me today. My name is Amanda Kohler, and I lead the Land Stewardship Project's Soil Health and Climate Campaign. LSP is a grassroots people's organization that focuses on building a just and sustainable farm and food system. We have more than 4,500 member households across the Midwest, primarily rural residents and small and mid-sized farmers in Minnesota. The bill before you today is a farmer-grown and farmer-driven proposal. Over 2,000 people engaged in our listening sessions, surveys, one-to-one meetings to shape this legislation, which was finalized by a team of 15 farmer and rural members. Across the state and beyond, farmers are innovating on the landscape by implementing sustainable and regenerative practices and seeing countless benefits from lowered input costs to newfound resiliency from extreme weather events. However, as Representative Lippert said, the science is still emerging. In order to effectively build the health of our soil and build resiliency across Minnesota, we need to understand how different practices impact various soil health indicators in different soil profiles across the state, because those are very diverse in Minnesota. That's why the data collection section of this bill is so crucial. As Representative Lippert said, we've worked with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Minnesota Office of Soil Health in shaping this language, and we will continue to consult them as we move forward. Just last week, this bill passed out of the Agriculture Finance and Policy Committee with a 11-1 vote. And so on behalf of our members across the state, I urge you to vote yes on this bill. We want to continue this crucial conversation in our next and final committee, the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee. And I'm also happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kohler, and welcome to your co-presenter there. I don't believe you have any other testifiers, Representative Lippert, so we'll move now to member questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the bill's author for taking that amendment from Min Koji. I think that's an improvement on the bill. I'll be encouraging my members to vote no on this bill today. It spends $2.75 million for something that is already happening largely. Farmers are already doing this sorts of thing now through precision agriculture. There's so much, there's soil probes, there's all sorts of precision ag tools out there right now for farmers to use, and they are using because they want to make sure that their soil is rich and healthy, as that's their livelihood. And so I think this is a waste of money, and $2.75 million could be spent very wisely in other places. So while I like the amendment, makes the bill better, I'm encouraging my members to vote no. Thank you.
Representative Lippert, response.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks, Representative Scott, for the comments on the amendment and the bill as well. I'll say a few things. So I represent the Northfield area. We've seen three separate 500-year floods downtown due to the Cannon River in the last 10 years. One of the main things we need to do is have farmers able to hold more water back on the landscape. These practices are key to it. And there are farmers who are experimenting with these practices, but there are more who want to utilize them. And they talk with me about needing financial assistance to get started. I had one farmer talk with me just last week and about something else. I mentioned this bill. He held up a soil or a cover crop catalog and said, I want to do this. And I went to my banker to talk about it, and my banker wouldn't help me find a way. So I need to find a way to do this. We want to support farmers in putting these practices in place quickly. The state of Maryland has a robust cover crop program in place for farmers. They have 50% of their land covered. Indiana's close behind at 40%. We're at 3 to 5% covered in Minnesota because we don't have the financial supports in place. This is a very important place for us to invest funds to protect our soils going forward.
All right, next up we have Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would echo Representative Scott's comments just to add, I mean, so I do a lot of ag landing. It's what I do. I wouldn't hesitate to work with a farmer who wanted to do this. If it's truly beneficial for the farm, they would be doing it. And I've got a lot of customers that are moving in this direction on their own. So, you know, I'm opposed to the government telling them what they have to do. If this is good for them, they will do that. And the industry will move that way. And it has moved that way. So I respectfully oppose the bill as well for those reasons. Thank you.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Farr. So this is these are simply incentives, and farmers are saying they'd like to do this. And this, you know, the farmer I mentioned, he went to the banker and said, I know this is going to make me money in the long term, but I need some help getting there. And couldn't convince the lender that this would be good in the long term. Even though there's more and more research that's saying that's the case, more farmers are saying that's the case. So we want to support farmers in getting these practices on the land so it'll benefit their bottom line too.
All right, Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing this great bill forward. I think it's telling that in the Agriculture Committee, where you, I'm sure, dove really deep into all provisions of this bill, you had such a broad bipartisan vote on it. And it seems to me that the concerns we've heard raised are speaking to something that's not in the bill, which is you're trying to incentivize folks to do work voluntarily that they want to do, and paying farmers to do good practices that typically hasn't been that controversial in either the federal or the state government. But I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit to, you know, what we heard, I think, in the Climate and Energy Committee from a few farmers who are doing these types of practices. And what are some of the barriers that you're hearing from farmers who want to start to do these practices but might not have the information they need?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. So the farmers that are experimenting with these practices, as I talk with them again and again and again, I hear how excited they are about what they're seeing on their soil. They're seeing their soil retain more water in tremendous ways. They're seeing more and more organic matter in their soil, more activity in their soil, better productivity over time, water quality gains, and they're excited to be a part of the climate solution with these sorts of practices. But also, as they're talking with their neighbors who are interested in trying it, there are two clear obstacles. One is financial assistance, because it can be hard when dollars are tight in the ag economy. Where, you know, we've had many years of hard prices. It'd be hard to put a financial outlay out in the short term for long-term gains. And the second is technical assistance, and this bill addresses that too. Any mistake in farming is costly, so we want to provide support for farmers so they can do this right and see the gains in their soils and in their pocketbooks as well.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mueller, Representative Lipper, I understand the concept of this bill, and you brought up Maryland, which is a totally different climate than we have in Minnesota. The two biggest crops in Minnesota or actually the three are probably, number one is corn, number two is beans, and number three is beets. I was reading through the bill, and corn and beans would be very difficult to put a cover crop in once they're harvested. It's done after beans, it could possibly be done, but that's, again, after the frost when beans are harvested. And corn, a lot of times, is harvested in the snow. Farmers already do a rotating. They know that the benefits of that. They're doing no-till as much as possible. So a lot of farmers are doing this already. In fact, they get down to the science so they know which part of the field actually needs more fertilizer or nitrogens or potash or whatever. They have the programs they're using. The equipment you're talking about can be expensive. We know most farmers already, a lot of them already have that equipment because they know it's the best practices. So I got concerns that the goals are lofty in this, getting 100% cover crop or 90% by a certain time. I'm trying to remember going through the bill. But these goals I don't think are sustainable unless we get rid of corn and beans and go to just winter wheat or the grass crop. That's the only way to do that through this program. And that's going to hurt our ethanol industry as well that we have here in Minnesota. So I have some issues with this. But also we adopted a couple amendments, and we never did hear what those amendments did. I was wondering if you could explain them.
All right. Representative Lippert, if you could explain those, that would be great. And then we're going to move to Representative Holland's question. I'll just remind members that we are focusing the discussion today on sections 1 and 4 of the bill. But go ahead, Representative Lippert, and explain those amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. I did touch on those amendments, but I will do so again. You adopted amendments to change subdivision 6A and also language in section 4. The 6A language is a compromise language we worked out with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, and that allows for the data related to farmer soils to remain private because we want to make sure that farmers aren't penalized for varying soil types, the quality of their soil, and lots changing in this area of carbon markets in a hurry. We want farmers to be able to manage their own data. And then at the same time, the contact information of the farmers who are receiving grant funds is public data. And then in section 4, we work with the Minnesota Office for Soil Health to make clear the data is related to emerging science and to change measurement happening on every field to various fields to provide helpful indicators for this science going forward. And just to respond to the previous comments, there's exciting research happening related to cover crops and sugar beets, and it's precisely the row crop farmers, the corn and soybean farmers who are excited about cover crops, are utilizing cover crops with their rotations right now, but want to do it even better and even more.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. And I believe a hand was up and now it's down. Representative Hollins, did you have a question or comment? We are unable to hear you, Representative Hollins. All right.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm currently driving. I withdraw my question. I'll follow up with Representative Lippert separately. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lippert, did you have any final words on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the committee for their time today. This is a very important bill for the resiliency of our soils and for our communities now and going forward. So I ask for your support.
Seeing no further discussion from the committee, I renew my motion that House File 701, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn is excused. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Farr. Okay. You have 9 ayes and 4 nays.
All right, here. There being 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails and House File 701, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Members, the next bill is House File 478 from Representative Feist. Courts provided guidance on sentencing veterans for criminal offenses related to service-related disorder. And Representative Feist, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move my bill, House File 478, to be referred to the Public Safety Committee.
All right, very well. And I don't see that we have any amendments to your bill, so why don't you go ahead and tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am honored to be carrying the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. This bill creates a statewide access to specialized restorative sentencing structure for eligible veterans who have committed lower level criminal offenses as a direct result of a service-related condition. This bill has the support of a broad coalition of stakeholders, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, veterans groups, as well as victims' advocates, such as Violence Free Minnesota, which provided a letter in support that is with the materials today. I had the privilege to sit in on a veterans treatment court hearing recently. It was an eye-opening experience to see the process, which was so affirming and really focused on the veterans' whole lives as the court staff worked to provide the veterans with the support they needed to graduate from the program and succeed in life. Incredibly, this personalized approach to sentencing is projected to save $1.2 million. And briefly, I'd just like to describe it because we have limited testimony today. But the way it works is that they have a staffing meeting beforehand, which includes the judge, prosecutor, probation officer, and mentor coordinator. And they really talk about all of the veterans who will be appearing before the court and look at the context of their lives, the progress they've made, and really look at them as people. And then they have the hearings afterwards. And it was a really, like I said, it was really affirming to see how the veterans were treated by the court as real people. This bill makes us safer through impressive reduced recidivism by providing the support to veterans to confront their acts, seek the treatment that they need and deserve, and rejoin the community of law-abiding citizens. Attorney Ryan Else will be walking through the bill in detail, but I'd like to emphasize some elements of the bill at the outset. First, in talking about this bill with victims' advocacy groups, they have appreciated the requirement of a direct nexus between the criminal behavior and the service-related injury or trauma. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card for any veteran. And second, I want to emphasize that the restorative approach is rigorous. It would be much easier to accept a guilty plea and serve out probation passively. By selecting the restorative approach to sentencing, the veteran is choosing to confront their actions, seek the treatment that they need, and commit to achieving their full potential in life. I would like to end my introduction with a quote from a constituent of mine who emailed me regarding this bill. She wrote, "My father was in World War II. He came home crazy and got no help. My mother tried to get help, but to no avail. His alcoholism and PTSD made our family life hell. No one and no family should ever have to suffer like we and millions of others have suffered. If my dad had been able to get all the aspects of treatment courts, his life could have turned around and our family could have thrived." I will turn it over now to our testifiers, including Ryan Else, an attorney who will walk through the bill, as well as Chris Finden, who has gone through this program. And we also have Ben Johnson, the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, on hand if there are questions that he can answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. So Ryan Else, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Ryan Else. I am a practicing criminal defense lawyer. I'm the legislative chair of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I'm a veteran. We started back in 2017 on a state grant to look into how to expand and standardize the veteran treatment courts, assembled a group of prosecutors, the chief public defender, representatives of the state and federal VA, and judges from some of the prominent veterans courts. And we quickly landed on the understanding that the best way to expand and standardize the veteran treatment court benefits would be a statutory model that enshrines the best practices and allows counties that can't afford a formal veteran treatment court to follow the same model. And we agreed that the courts that are most successful offer a stay of adjudication, which is a mechanism by which a plea is entered by the veteran but not accepted by the court. A conviction's never entered against the veteran, and they have the opportunity to earn their way out of the case without a conviction at all. Chris Vinden will talk about how he went through the Veterans Treatment Court but was not granted the ability to avoid a conviction and the problems that that's caused for him since. The treatment that veterans have to go through to address the combat trauma that led to the criminality in the first place is really difficult. It involves going through the most painful experience in their life over and over again until they can be comfortable with it. To do that, they need a very strong legal incentive, and this bill does that. Understanding the benefits of that, we have got the support from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Chief Public Defender, Bill Ward, the Violence-Free Minnesota on behalf of domestic violence victims, and the Minnesota Social Workers Association. And I've been told to keep it short, so I will cut it off there and answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Elf. And I believe the next testifier is Chris Vinden. So welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HF 478. My name is Christopher Vinden. Currently employed as Homeless Outreach County Veteran Service Officer, providing housing and resources to veterans within the metro area. I served in the United States Marine Corps from 2002 to 2010 and included combat deployments to North Africa, Iraq, humanitarian aid to Ukraine, and Hurricane Katrina emergency relief in New Orleans, Louisiana. Returning home, I ended up facing homelessness that due to identification theft that occurred while I was overseas. It took a hit toll on my credit. So I was sleeping in my vehicle. I quickly ran into legal issues with multiple DUIs, and I found out very quickly you can receive DUIs, even though you're not driving. It's called being in control of a motorized vehicle while under the influence. It occurred multiple times. See, I was accepted into Veterans Court in 2014 after an incident, and the judge had looked at my record and wanted to assure that I was going to get the help that I needed. Was amongst the first in the Ramsey County Vet Court, and they basically, like what Ryan had stated, that they would have you focus on the treatment at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center. There's psychiatry and physical one-on-one personal therapy, and they hold you accountable to make those appointments. Frequent UAs required. And what Veterans Court did to me is that it provided positive direction and mentorship, direction in life, and face the issues, mental health issues that I was facing amongst return. It's among the first to graduate in 2015. And since then, becoming an asset to the community. I appeared in the TPT special, Crossing the Threshold, which addressed reasons for veterans' homelessness and causes, Suits for Soldiers by the WCCO with, at the time, Holly Wagner, and lots of volunteer work with nonprofits, in particular suicide awareness and crisis response. Now married, I received the Veterans Voice Award in 2016 from the Minnesota Humanitarian Center for my contributions to the community, received an associate arts degree, bachelor arts degree in social work, and a master's in business and administration. I wanted to pursue the master's of social work and pursue clinical therapy. However, upon acceptance into St. Thomas and other schools, I was never provided a straight answer as to if I could obtain licensure and go on to become a clinical therapist or even having my own private clinical therapy facility. So I want to become an even bigger asset to the community by providing more in-depth professional services to other veterans. But also with this bill, I believe that other veterans will become an even bigger asset to the community as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vinden. And I just wanted to say thank you so much to all the veterans for your service, but especially for you for coming today and sharing your story. Also want to wish you congratulations for your successes and also a continued thank you for what you're doing to improve our communities in Minnesota. So thank you very much. Members, I see that Chair Becker Finn is back in the room, so I'm going to virtually turn the gavel back over to her as we start with member questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Moeller, for keeping the ship going while I wasn't here. We'll go to member questions. I see Representative Novotny.
There we go. Too many buttons. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. I see that the bill lists less crimes with the felony level of 7 or 7A. Last time I checked, that still included domestic assault, strangulation, and I'm told that there is an exclusion possibly for sexual assault crimes not being eligible. Could you clarify that? Is domestic assault, strangulation going to be covered, eligible for inclusion in this program and any CSCs?
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. I am looking at my list of crimes that would qualify, and you are correct that domestic assault by strangulation under 609.2247 would be covered under this bill. And I would just like to emphasize that Violence Free Minnesota really supports this legislation because it allows veterans who have undergone trauma as part of their service and as a result have been charged with these crimes, there has to be that direct nexus. It allows them and really encourages them to seek the programming that they need in order to heal. They are going to continue to be in the lives of the people who are the victims of their crimes. And this restorative approach to sentencing has really dramatically reduced recidivism and improved the lives of the entire families. Thank you for the question.
Follow-up, Representative Botany.
I'd just like to say that although I'm not a veteran, supportive of all veterans, my father was a veteran service officer for over 20 years. We actually worked together on several cases with veterans that were needing help. And, yesterday we were talking about diversion for juveniles. Well, we were doing some unofficial pretrial diversion on minor cases for veterans back when we were able to help someone that needed that help 20 years ago. The inclusion of the eligibility to participate in this program from someone that's committed domestic assault, strangulation, or criminal sexual assault is the one thing that's blocking me on this. I will have to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Devotny. Next up, I have Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, could I answer one question?
Real quick, Representative Feist, I want to make sure we have time for a discussion of your bill.
Yep, thank you so much. I just wanted to mention, Madam Chair, I don't know that criminal sexual conduct is actually covered by this bill, and Mr. Els could verify, but I'm looking at the list of high-level domestic violence crimes that are not covered, and I see that first, second, third, and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct is not included. And Mr. Els, maybe you can confirm this.
Mr. Els.
Any crime for which predatory offense would be required is not included in this bill. So that would include all of the sex crimes other than criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree, which is not.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Els. All right. Going to move on to Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members. I like the concept of this bill. But I do have problems with it. One is the severity level, level 7 on the normal scale on the sentencing guidelines, and also on the D7 level on the drug stuff. But I have other concerns. In the drug courts, there's special qualifications for a person to be able to get in. I don't know if this follows those same mandates. Not every vet can get in into the drug system where they have the drug courts. I'd love to expand the drug courts. I think that's the way we need to go instead of something wide open like this, because I don't think there's as many places where they can make sure things are going on. On the fiscal note, it does not include the extra intensive probation that's required in the drug courts as well, and all the extra court time that the drug courts use. But there's another issue that I have. I want to support our vets. My father was a vet. My father-in-law is a veteran. I got many friends that are in the military now. My family's been involved for years with the military. But we also have a premise that this country goes by, that we're all equal under the law. When we do something like this for a special section of our population, are we in violation of that press, that thing that we stand so dearly, that we're all equal under the law or not? That's a question we need to ask ourselves. If we're going to do it just for the vets, should this be for everybody? Because we're taking out and giving a certain part of our population special rights and special privileges. So that's something that we need to look at and try to decide if this is the right thing to do. It might be, but if it's just veterans, are we treating everybody equally? Thank you. And right at this time, I cannot support this bill for a number of reasons.
Okay, moving on, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question for Christopher, and I can't see the last name. Is it Vinden?
Right, yes.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair and Mr. Vinden, did you complete this course or one like it, or were you just a person that went through the Veterans Court? I'm trying to distinguish between the two here.
Mr. Vinden.
I completed the Veterans Court treatment program from 2014 to 2015.
Okay, so Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you haven't actually been through one of these programs in another state or anything, but you did go through the Veterans Court. I just want to clarify that before I ask the next question.
That was here in Minnesota, Ramsey County.
Okay, so Veterans Court. So with a program like, did you think that it was really important? Or would you think that it's important for someone to, if they're in a program like this, that they not just that they finish the program? Is that an important concept to you for this program to fully work? Would you think that a person would have to complete the program?
Absolutely,
Mr. Vinden.
Okay, well, thank you. And the reason I ask is because that's one of the issues I have with this bill right now is there's no requirement that they finish the program to get all of these other things, all of these other, for the record of the offense to disappear. And the author can certainly correct me on this, or the attorney that testified, but I don't see in here anywhere where there's a requirement to finish the program. And I think that is so important because you can be a body and show up to things a few times, but if you don't finish a program like this, I don't know that it's going to be as effective. And if the goal is to reduce recidivism, then to me, the program should have to be completed. And so that's one of my issues with it. And then the whole thing, I'm shocked to pieces that the domestic violence, the advocates against domestic violence would support this bill, given the level of assault that that they can commit and still go through this program and have those levels of crimes, basically no record of it anymore. So I have those two concerns. And so I don't know if the bill's author would like to address the issue of completion. Maybe I misread the bill.
Representative Feist, and then we'll move to Representative Hollins and the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the way that this process works, and Mr. Ells can confirm, but the veteran would plead guilty, and then the judge would offer a stay of adjudication. And that would basically hang over their head until the veteran had satisfactorily completed the program. And so the way it works in a traditional veterans court system is that they go through levels until they formally graduate. This would create that model. And Mr. Ells, if you could clarify, how would someone, quote unquote, like complete the program if they're in a system where there is the model but not a formal veterans treatment court? I assume the judge and the prosecutor agree that the veteran has like completed the program.
Mr. Ells, real quick.
Correct. I think the confusion comes in that in looking at best practices, we wanted to make sure that substantial compliance was sufficient. We have some veterans who go through a treatment program, say they go to the St. Cloud VA's inpatient program, and they don't get a graduation certificate, but they have gained the benefit of it. The end of supervision hearing would allow that veteran to make that case to the judge, and the judge has to make sure that they are rehabilitated. If you look in subdivision 2B, it lays out the factors that the judge must consider to decide if the veteran has satisfied the program. We just did not want anything where it was overly formalistic, because we have seen veterans who have gone into these programs because of the deep trauma treatment. They'll get a week from graduation and not finish the program. That shouldn't be a strict legal bar to them getting relief under the program if they've gotten the rehabilitative benefit. A judge is not going to dismiss a serious felony if they feel that veteran's not rehabilitated. I think it's just it isn't credible given the experience we have with judges in the criminal justice system. They're not looking to just throw these serious cases out. And the judge under subdivision 2C has the ability to deny that relief to the veteran if they have not demonstrated rehabilitation, or if the victim comes in and convinces the judge that the harm from the offense was just too much, then the judge can still deny that dismissal. We wanted to put this in the hands of the judge and let them determine whether or not the veteran's rehabilitated.
Madam Chair.
Real quick, Representative Scott, or we're not going to have time for everything.
Well,
else.
I understand. And I just wanted to report that the majority leader, Representative Winkler, just tweeted out that Republicans on House Judiciary suck up to law enforcement and claim that they care about veterans. Then they vote against a bill creating veteran court supported by law enforcement. They just sound stupid, covering up their hypocrisy. And I think that is very below the belt and very it's sort of, I would be ashamed to have tweeted out something like this. This isn't about Veterans Court, Representative Winkler. This is an entirely different bill. And so for him to tweet that out, I think is irresponsible as one of the big leaders, one of the primary leaders in the House of Representatives. I think it's really disgusting. We want to support the veterans. Maybe there's some tweaks to this bill that could happen to make us this bill something that we can support. But I really don't think somebody that is accused of strangulation should be allowed to just have that that kind of a crime erased. And I think they should have to finish this course. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. And Representative Scott, I will note that I cannot control Majority Leader Winkler. And, you know, it is my goal here to keep us focused on the bill and how we can make the bill better. I will say to that issue, I spent many years working with domestic violence victims and advocates. And one thing I do think is important for folks to remember is that sometimes what is best for victims seems counterintuitive to us from the outside as folks who are not going through the process. And a lot of times these are men who or women, you know, who are the co-parents with domestic violence victims. They're people that they are always going to have contact with. And I just want to note that sometimes it can seem counterintuitive, but maintaining being completely victim-centered means listening to victims when they tell us what the thing is that's going to best keep them alive in their situation. And that not isn't always the criminal justice process in the way that we think of it typically as prosecutors and, you know, law enforcement and part of the system. And so I just want to note that because I think it's really important. Members, Representative Hollins was the only one who had her hand up initially. We do need to move on to the next vote. So I am going to make the call. I apologize to Representative Hollins and the others with their hands up, but we are going to move to the vote. And with that, Representative Feist, say we don't really even have time for closing comments, so we're just going to go straight to the vote. Anna, please go ahead with the roll. Thank you.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Herr.
I don't think Novotny came across, but I was a no.
Perfect. And Representative Novotny votes no. Perfect. There are 10 ayes and 5 nays.
All right, the motion prevails. And just to remind folks, the motion was that House File 478 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. If there are still concerns, I encourage folks to talk with the author. You know, there is time to address some of the concerns and hopefully get more folks on board with this important bill. So thank you, Representative Feist. With that, we will move on to the next bill on our agenda, which is House File 1163. Representative Winkler, this is your bill. I will move that House File 1163 be recommended to be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1163 is the Driver's Licenses for All Act, the driver's license bill that makes sure that communities across Minnesota have greater public safety, a stronger economy, and a better life for immigrants and people throughout our communities. This bill has been passed in the Minnesota Senate twice. It has passed the Minnesota House at least once. in 2019. It is currently the law in 15 states. The record of success with this bill for our roads is clear. In California and Connecticut, they saw significant decreases in hit and run accidents after this passed. In Utah and New Mexico, saw a huge drop, 20 to 24% drop in people driving without auto insurance after they passed this bill. This bill allows people to get to work. It allows families to get to childcare and activities. It allows kids to get to school, and it allows workers to stay better connected to the workplace. As of 2018, there were 30,000 children in Minnesota whose parents had were with at least one parent who was undocumented. And 68% of undocumented immigrants in Minnesota have frontline jobs. So we are talking about families with children. We are talking about people who are doing essential work. We are talking about a bill that will increase public safety by making our roads safer. You only get a driver's license if you can pass the test and you have insurance. And the bill is supported by a wide range of organizations and individuals. We're going to hear from Archbishop Hebda. We're going to hear from a police officer from St. Paul. We are going to hear from the milk producers. You have a letter of support from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. This bill has been a long time in coming. And members, I ask you to listen carefully to the testimony, listen carefully to understand why it matters so much to so many people. And I would ask you to consider voting in support of this bill today. We used to have this law in place. It used to be permissible to get a driver's license without proving your immigration status. That changed in 2003, and we have been leaving Minnesota communities behind for a long time, and it's time to right that wrong. I ask for your vote today.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. We have a lot of testifiers on the agenda this morning, so we're going to get right to testimony. I will just remind all the testifiers that we only have 2 minutes apiece, and it's not personal, but I will have to cut you off so that there's time for member discussion afterwards. First on the list is Lucas Sjostrom. If you could introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. For the record, my name is Lucas Sjostrom. I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, a member of the Minnesota Agri-Growth Council. I'm also a partner in my family's dairy farm and cheese operation. Both Minnesota Milk and Agri-Growth are founding members of the Movement for Driver's Licenses for All. Minnesota and our agriculture and food employers have a labor shortage. Many jobs require high skills, and many others are entry-level jobs that require hard work. Our Minnesota economy relies on immigrant labor to fill many of these jobs. One thing you often hear in the debate over how to better accommodate workers through education, immigration visas, and accommodations to get people into employment is whether we want people with low skills or high skills. I'm here to tell you today that Minnesota dairy farmers and many other employers in agriculture in Minnesota employ people with a very high skill, hard work. These employees are also willing to and want to put in the effort to study, practice, and pass a driver's license test, as well as pay money for insurance. But today, some of them cannot do that. That limits skills from being acquired, commerce from being transacted, and a higher level of safety from being realized. We want our families and employees to be safe and able to travel our state, whether to home, school, or work. That goal may be only achieved when every driver learned and passed driver safety training. Without opportunity, expectation is not achievable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sjostrom. Next on the list is Archbishop Hebda. Archbishop, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bernard Hebda. I'm the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis. I joined the meeting today to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference in support of House File 1163. Thank you, Representative Winkler and the other bill authors who have reintroduced this urgently needed remedy for the approximately 90,000 undocumented people in our state. Allowing undocumented persons to obtain provisional driver's licenses serves the common good in several ways. Most importantly, public safety is promoted by having more licensed drivers on the road, who studies have shown are less likely to be involved in fatal accidents and also are more likely to be insured. One objection to this legislation is that it will reward lawbreaking and undermine respect for the rule of law. Let me address that objection head on. Almost everyone acknowledges that we have a broken immigration system that needs fixing. Sadly, Congress has not passed comprehensive reform legislation. We cannot wait. Minnesota needs to act now to limit the threat that a traffic stop will upend lives and families of our friends and neighbors. Our immigrant brothers and sisters deserve to live with dignity, not in fear of being separated from their families every time they need to drive somewhere. Too often we let secondary relationships define our identities and how we treat others. We may see ourselves as American citizens and immigrants as illegals or aliens. How unfortunate if those labels limit the reach of our solidarity. Instead, we must first identify ourselves as brothers and sisters, all children of the same God, each possessing the dignity of being created in his image and likeness. It is unthinkable that there would be borders in his kingdom, nor should there be borders around our hearts. This bill is one of the most important things we can do for our immigrant brothers and sisters here in Minnesota. Immigrants are here to stay and will continue to drive to meet their needs. Let us both make everyone safer and help the strangers in our midst so that perhaps they can become strangers to us no longer. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Archbishop. Next is Gregory McNamara. If you want to introduce yourself, and please go ahead with your testimony.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
My name is Dr. Greg McNamara. I'm a family physician in Little Falls, Minnesota. I also volunteer to see undocumented workers in Waite Park through a grant from Centricare at St. Joseph's Parish. The vast majority of the patients that I see work at local farms. They do the work that no one else wants to do. I know this because I also take care of multiple farm families who hire these people. These people need a mode of transportation, and without a driver's license, that is impossible. They are forced to drive illegally to even get groceries. There is no mode of public transportation. This has led to a fear, as the bishop has stated, of law enforcement, and it's gotten to the point now where they're even afraid to drive to the doctor's office. I have been seeing patients from Little Falls at the free clinic in Waite Park because of this fear. One patient in particular recently was not taking his medication for several months because of this fear about coming back into our clinic. If you think about what could happen to people like that, the delayed medical care that they would require could end with disastrous results. And economically, it would be very difficult for the medical system because they have no insurance to pay for those types of that type of care. I realize that these people are here illegally because of our broken immigration policies. But the fact of the matter is they are not going anywhere. They are also an integral part of our local economy and an integral part of our farm industry. And to be perfectly honest, why should they be able to drive a car without paying for a license? That affects us all economically. These people deserve to be allowed to have a driver's license in order to perform these essential jobs and get the medical care they need. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dr. McNamara. Next on the list is Commander Pam Berrigan. Commander, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Pamela Berrigan, and I'm a St. Paul Police Commander with the Community Partnerships Unit. I have worked in law enforcement for 25 years, and I have been in this country for 30 years. My unit's mission is to intentionally be the bridge between our racially and ethnically diverse communities and the police department. We need to be in partnership with our residents to ensure everyone is safe. Therefore, in behalf of the St. Paul Police Department, I'm here to testify in support of this bill. Granting driver's license to immigrants could improve road safety and accountability. Individuals are typically required to complete a driver's education class, pass a driving test, and take a behind-the-wheel driving test before obtaining a license. During this time, the person learns to properly operate the vehicle, to interpret various traffic signs and the rules of the road that make driving a safety activity. knowledge of driving laws and practices can contribute to highway safety. Allowing all residents to obtain a license or state ID would promote public safety. Law enforcement officers may use driver license or state IDs to identify the individuals they encounter. This can eliminate the need for officers to handle other identification documents, which may not be easily available or may not be in English. Law enforcement officials have the critical task of investigating crimes, responding to emergencies, and keeping communities safe. A state-issued identification document would help officers to be more efficient. In addition, these cards can be helpful to first responders in identifying people needing emergency medical assistance. These are real reasons that impact many lives. We as a collective have the responsibility to ensure public safety and financial responsibility by licensing and insuring as many drivers as possible. I urge you to pass House File 1163. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up is Julia Decker. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Julia Decker. I'm the Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. As many of you on this committee know, often through working with us on these issues, the ACLU of Minnesota is a strong advocate for data privacy and data protections. And while the context of this bill is driver's licenses instead of student data or information collected by drones, in line with those same principles, we at the ACLU do support the data protections included in House File 1163. People who would gain access to a driver's license or ID card through this bill but do not have proof of citizenship or lawful presence are more likely to be people who are already marginalized. Not every Minnesotan who is a citizen necessarily possesses proof of citizenship or lawful presence. People with low income, people facing homelessness or unstable housing situations, victims of domestic violence or trafficking may not have the means or ability to access these vital documents. In addition, non-citizens may not have proof of citizenship or lawful presence for a number of reasons. Many applications for immigration status or even renewal of an immigration status can take months to fully be processed, and this can easily leave a non-citizen without that paper proof of their lawful presence. The data protections in this bill will encourage more Minnesotans, citizen and non-citizen alike, to go through the licensing process. And all Minnesotans will benefit from increased public safety if more drivers are licensed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Decker, and thank you for speaking to the data provisions. Next up is Irina Mosetazuma. If you could introduce yourself, I understand we might have an interpreter assisting as well.
Hola, buenos días. Mi nombre es Irina Moctezuma. Vivo en la ciudad de Lisur por casi 17 años. Viajo todos los días a San Peter a mi trabajo. Yo, ya que soy manager de una tienda mexicana, se llama La Mexicana Market de San Peter, por 7 años trabajando ahí. Es difícil para mí no tener una licencia de conducir, ya que la necesito para ir a trabajar. El precio de la aseguranza es muy alto cuando tengo registrado mi auto con mi matrícula consular y no licencia de Minnesota. Soy madre soltera con 2 hijos y el alto costo de la aseguranza desbalanza mis finanzas. Si yo tuviera la licencia de manejo, no tendría que preguntar de alguien más para asegurar mi auto. He comparado los precios de las aseguranzas con los miembros de mi familia que tienen licencia de Minnesota y ellos pagan alrededor de $70 cuando yo pago el triple de más de $200 mensuales por no tener licencia. Hace unos 2 años viví una mala experiencia con un accidente que no fue mi culpa. Alguien me golpeó y como no estaba registrada en la aseguranza de mi familiar, no pude resolver nada. Se complicó todo el proceso y salí perdiendo. Necesito una licencia para conducir de forma segura en Minnesota y seguir siendo parte del crecimiento en lo económico de nuestra comunidad. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. And I understand Mr. Eifler may be translating for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eraifer Jaramillo. I'm here on behalf of COPAR, and I'll be translating for Irina Moctezuma, who is one of the 90,000 affected directly by the lack of driver's licenses. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Irina Moctezuma. I have lived in the city of Le Sueur for almost 17 years. I travel to St. Peter every day to work, as I have been manager of La Mexicana Market in St. Peter for 7 years. It is difficult for me not to have a driver's license, as I needed to go to work and keep the business running. The price of insurance is very high when I have to register with a consular ID and not a Minnesota license. I am a single mother with two children, and the high cost of insurance throws my finances out of balance. If I had a driver's license, I wouldn't have to ask someone else to insure my car. I've compared the insurance prices with family members who are insured in Minnesota, and they pay $70, while I pay more than triple that amount, close to $200. About 2 years ago, I had a bad experience in an accident that was not my fault. Someone hit me, and since I was not registered with my family's insurance, I could not solve anything. The whole process was very complicated, and I lost. I need a license to drive safely in Minnesota and continue to be part of the economic growth of our community. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your assistance, Mr. Jaramillo. Next, we have Norm Nyivu. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Ms. Chair?
Go ahead, please introduce yourself.
This is Tao Mei Shang. I'm going to repeat his name in case he didn't understand. Norm Ningyi Vu. You have to unmute yourself so we can hear you.
Okay. I'm there?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Thank you. I live in Forest Lake. I own multiple businesses in Broken Center. I came to the United States as an orphan. Both my parents are died in the secret war in Laos. And I was the only surviving member of my immediate family. I arrived in Minnesota at the age of 20. I put myself through community college and got married with 5 children. Together with my wife and I, we start several small businesses and volunteer a lot in the community. Throughout my multiple business and community work, I interact with a lot of diverse people from background people in Broken Park and Broken Center. There are a large number of Hmong, Lao, Vietnamese, Liberians, Nigerians, and Latino in this area. They are all my kind friends and neighbors. I am sympathetic to their struggle since they do not have a driver license because they are undocumented and they can't travel, work, or participate in their children's life. I urge this committee to support HF 1163 bill. I urge this committee to support family unity, unification and family stability, allow parents to provide for their children. Please pass this bill and allow Minnesotans to be free and drive safely without fear. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That wraps up the people we have on the list to testify today. I do want to thank all of you. I didn't have to remind anyone that their 2 minutes was up. So good job to everybody, and thank you very much for testifying. With that, we will move on to member discussion. I do want to remind members that we are going to try to focus on Section Section 2 of the bill regarding, or Article 2 of the bill regarding data protection, since that is the jurisdiction of our committee, and this bill has several other stops along the way after us. I will also say we're going to stay focused on the bill. If there are concerns that individuals have with other individuals, those can happen offline, or I will need to just move on to somebody else. So first on the list, I have Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And the question is for the author. I was just wondering if you could clarify, in past versions of the bill and past use sessions, there's been an identification of placed on the card, just like we do for persons that aren't supposed to use drugs or alcohol or firearms endorsements or, before adults are able to legally drive or before kids turn 18. There's provisional things placed on the driver's license for identification. So could the author clarify, is there an identification placed on the card that identifies the person with the driver's license as a non-resident? And yes, thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Winkler. And I'd just like to say, My grandmother used to say the only weapon that gets sharper with use is the tongue, and now I believe it's Twitter. And thank you for reminding me why I don't use Twitter.
Yep. Representative Winkler, to the actual question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, the version of the bill that we brought forward to final passage in 2019 did include that identifier. And I think that we are open to, I am open to amending the bill to put together the bipartisan support that we need, especially in the Senate, to move this through and become law. But when we're starting out the process from the beginning again, we are starting the bill from the place where we think it is best, which is as drafted currently. So I'm open to those conversations to figure out how to improve it. If you are interested in engaging on that, and that's something that we could work on and get your support on the bill, I'm very much open to that. And so there isn't a need to have that marker on there. This is not a real ID. It's only a driving card, just like a regular driver's license that anybody else would have is. You can't use it to get on an airplane. You can't use it for federal purposes or anything else. So there is already those limitations built into the bill. Adding those markers on it doesn't add anything to the security or the protections built into proving who you are or your identity. So it was kind of a comfort language or sort of thing, I guess, in order to build bipartisan support last year. And we wanted to start the bill where we think it's best policy and then amend it if we need to.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Novotny?
Yes, thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Representative Winkler, as someone who, in 33 years in law enforcement, we do have a migrant community that comes through for our large potato field area, involved in numerous investigations where undocumented workers were, in most of the cases, victims. So having some form of identification to help even with the language barrier and dealing with those victims, yes, it would have been nice to have some documented form of identification. I just am torn by the fact that they aren't identified on the licenses, as that's what it is. So thank you.
All right. Next on the list is Representative Scott to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my understanding then, Representative Winkler, is that their driver's license is going to look exactly like mine because I did not get a real ID compliant driver's license. So their driver's license will look exactly like mine. Is that right?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes, that is my understanding based on your question. It would be a regular Class D driver's license.
Madam Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Winkler, what's to prevent someone that's here illegally and obtains a driver's license that looks just like mine from using it to vote?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, first of all, picture ID is not required to vote currently. To vote without being a U.S. citizen is a felony. And we have voting records in which people have to establish their citizenship in order to be able to register to vote in the first place. So having this ID would be of no use in obtaining the right to vote through getting registered and casting a ballot.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, but a person can apply for an absentee ballot or to vote by mail, and all they have to do is show a driver's license. And this would allow them to do that. So do you have any concerns that could happen?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, you don't just need a driver's license to get an absentee ballot. You also need to swear that you are a U.S. citizen, and you have your data checked after the fact by the Secretary of State or the county, in many cases both. So I don't see any possible basis for using a driving, think of this as like a driving card, not the key to identity in, you know, every walk of life in Minnesota. This is just the ability to gain access legally to the roadway. And so there's really no way to use this in order to create a place in the voting registration system that would allow you to even get an absentee ballot.
Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Scott. And we have a couple other hands up.
I understand. This is my final question. I'm trying to get to the section that applies to our committee today. There's no mechanism for the Secretary of State in this bill because they cannot share someone's legal status in this country with outside government entities. There's no way that the Secretary of State would be able to verify or not whether this person is in our country legally, according to what the language that I see in this bill. So that's my concern here. And if the bill's author wants to emphasize and wants to protect these folks from going forward to vote, to prevent them from voting illegally, which he stated is a felony, then to me there should be some marking on this driver's license that that alerts the election authorities that these people are ineligible to vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Response, Representative Winkler.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I think this gets a little bit into the conversation we started with Representative Novotny about having some kind of marker on the driver's license. Again, I don't think it is the best policy to do it that way. And I think we risk the possibility of essentially, marking people out for discrimination potentially in our communities. But this driver's license bill is very, very important to a lot of people. And so I'm willing to enter into those conversations to build bipartisan support because it is helpful to so many people in so many parts of Minnesota.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like it when I can bring my immigration lawyer expertise. Ooh, I just raised my hand again by mistake. Try this again. So I just wanted to make two points just from the perspective of an immigration attorney. I think that the testifiers have discussed the importance of this to public safety, making sure that people who are already on our roads are trained and insured for all of our safety. But as an immigration lawyer, I would just like to point out that immigration law is dumb. And there are a lot of people who should be eligible for legal status who aren't able to get to the end of the process due to the way our laws are structured. We created a problem in 1996, a temporary solution in 1998, and that sunsetted in 2001. And ever since then, we have this issue with people being basically stuck inside the country. So I would just like to point out that we're talking about a lot of people who are parents and spouses of U.S. citizens and permanent residents, and allowing them to have access to a license would ensure that they can take care of their families, health care, educational needs, and just allow their family to live a full life here in Minnesota, where they are already living. And the other point I just wanted to make to Representative Scott's concerns, false claims to U.S. citizenship under immigration law are actually worse than most serious crimes. There is no way to get out of being deported if you made a false claim to U.S. citizenship, and that is interpreted incredibly broadly. And the immigrant communities that I've worked with over the last 20 years very much know that. So, you know, in theory, maybe there are immigrants out there who could theoretically want to vote, but I can tell you that this is something that everyone takes very seriously and knows that it is worse to vote illegally than it would be to commit like many serious crimes. So I just wanted to point that out as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist, for sharing your expertise with us. Next on the list is Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Majority Leader Winkler, thank you for bringing this forward. I do have a few problems with that, with this bill. One is the voting issue, because you actually do need an ID to vote in early voting in person. They do require an ID to verify that where you live. But that's not why I'm bringing it up today. And I was just wondering if I heard you correctly, Representative Winkler, that law enforcement does not, and other agencies do not have access to the immigration status on this driver's unidentified driver's license?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know that I actually discussed that yet, but yes, that is correct. The point here is that the data has to be kept private, or people will have a concern that if they apply for a driver's license, they will be effectively alerting ICE of their status and where they live. And therefore, people won't come forward to get a driver's license. They won't get insurance. They won't pass the test if we don't have that protection in the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. That brings up a major concern I have. I am a strong advocate for the Second Amendment, and I don't have many problems with the constitutional carry as well. As long as you're in this country legally and you can legally own a firearm and possess a firearm. But I have both the permit to acquire and permit to carry applications out in front of me at this time. And for identification purposes, to obtain a permit to acquire or for a permit to carry, you need a Minnesota driver's license or state ID number to get this form. And one of the disqualifications for possessing or purchasing a firearm in the United States is if you are not here legally, it is unlawful for you to purchase or carry a firearm. Now, the sheriff's offices and the police departments that handle these forms, you have just said, are not going to have access to the legal status of an individual. And in the NICS checks and the other background checks they do, they do not have access to that information either. So you're setting up a situation where a person who's already broke the law by coming into this country illegally has no problem signing a form that says they're not here legally, giving them a legal identification that is not marked in any way that they are not here in this country legally with a state identification card. That has great concern to me, and just for that reason alone, I cannot support this bill. Thank you.
Any response, Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it doesn't sound to me like changing the marking on the ID would necessarily get your vote. But as I said to Representative Scott and Representative Novotny, I am willing to work on that issue. I also want to point out that it is not a criminal act to be in the United States without lawful status. That is not the same kind of crime as professing to have a legal right to acquire a firearm and not in fact, having that right. So I'm afraid that I don't like the characterization of people who are here without status as being people who entered illegally or committed some, with the implication that they committed some kind of crime and are therefore willing or likely to commit other crimes. That is simply not the reality of what lacking status is in our immigration system today.
I do say that one of our testifiers, Ms. Decker from the ACLU, may have some information for us. So please go ahead, Ms. Decker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the point about the accessing the data, the way the bill is written, it's actually the data that would be accessed is just whether the proof of citizenship or lawful presence was provided, which actually doesn't go to necessarily to a question of immigration status. It's simply that a person did not have, at the time that they applied, didn't have a particular document showing citizenship or lawful presence. And as I stated in my earlier testimony, those could be people that for any variety of reasons did not at that particular time have that proof of presence. But that does not necessarily translate to any particular immigration status.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Yes. If a person is here legally, they can obtain a driver's license. It's called an international driver's license. A lot of people don't know about it, but if they're in this country legally and they had a driver's license where they were, they can obtain an international driver's license.
Okay. Representative Feist, real quick, and then we're going to move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Winkler's comment that people who are here legally also have trouble a lot of times getting driver's license. It can be so complicated what you need to prove your legal status. And I have so many clients over the years in Minnesota and everywhere who struggle to get a driver's license that they're actually totally entitled to. So this bill would help them as well. And a lot of those people are medical researchers just due to the very specific nature of their type of documentation. So this would be great for those folks as well. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Winkler, final comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the conversation. I am very much willing to work with anyone who is willing to work with me and with this amazing coalition of immigrants and people in communities around Minnesota who are standing up and working so hard, so diligently, and have done so for so long to get access, legal access to the roadway, to pass a driver's test, buy insurance, and be able to drive their kids to a doctor's appointment. These are very simple things. We all benefit from the immigrants in our communities, whether they are documented or undocumented. They said at the beginning, 68% of them performing in frontline occupations. We need these people in Minnesota. We count on them, we benefit from them, and then we, at the same time, we take these communities and say, you're not able to get access to something so basic as a driver's license. It doesn't make us safer, doesn't make our economy stronger, and it doesn't make our state a better place for anyone to live in. So we really need to right this wrong. And I appreciate the committee's time and would ask for your support today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Winkler, and thank you again to all the testifiers. I will renew my motion that House File 1163 be recommended to be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Rebecca Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel's excused. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen's excused. Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Perfect. There's 10 ayes and 5 nays.
All right, with 10 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and House File 1163 is on its way to the Transportation Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Winkler, and all of our testifiers. And with that, members, we did it. It's 9:58, our third committee meeting this week. Thank you, everybody, for your focus and attention. We do have a full week ahead of us next week. Many of those have already been posted, so please take a look at those. And thank you. We are adjourned.